What should I be feeding my pet is a question you hear every day. DVM 360 has answers. Join our Fetch Encore virtual symposium, Fueling Better Outcomes with Nutrition, on Sunday, May 17th. Earn 6 live CE credits from 4 veterinarian nutrition experts in just one day. Sign up now. And that's only the beginning. Fetch Encore is DVM 360's new way of bringing the personalized learning experience of Fetch veterinarian conferences directly to you. Check out more Fetch Encore throughout 2026. Cardiology, pain management, NAVLE guidance, tech talk, and feline medicine.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. You know, this episode's going to go to the neonates, the babies finally. We haven't really talked a lot about them, but the puppies and kittens and the microbiome through the life of puppies and kittens, a little bit of nutrition. We have a wonderful friend and colleague, Dr. Emmanuel Fontaine, in the house. How are you, my friend?
Hi, thanks, Adam, for having me. I'm good. I'm great. We were joking about that before we started. It's a little bit cold at the moment. I wish I were in Miami or Florida at the moment, but
yes,
super excited to be there to talk microbiome in puppies and kittens.
Yes, I am too. And I think by the time the listeners are going to get this, we're going to be saying, "Oh my gosh, we need the air conditioning." So. So it'll be good. It'll be good. I know. We'll think of this moment. And a little information about wonderful colleague, Dr. Fontaine. He graduated from the National Veterinary School of Toulouse in 2004. He subsequently specialized in reproduction at the National Veterinary School of Alfort and practiced from 2005 to 2011 at the Center for the Study of Carnivore Reproduction, a reference center for canine and feline reproduction. He's a diplomat of the European College of Animal Reproduction and obtained his PhD in 2012, focusing on the use of GnRH agonists in the bitch. With nearly 20 years of experience spanning clinical practice, research, teaching, and scientific communication, he's now an international speaker, an expert in clinical reproduction and canine and feline neonatology and pediatrics. And he's here with us today to talk more about this microbiome. Okay, I know from a standpoint that trying to figure out like, and I get this question actually from pet owners, they're trying to figure out like, when does it actually begin, Dr. Christian? So I want to know and share that with our listeners. When does colonization truly begin in puppies and kittens? And are there influences before birth, or is it strictly determined at and after delivery?
And you see, I love this question to start with, because it's actually, we used to think there is a theory called a hypothesis. Actually, it's called the sterile womb hypothesis, which tells you that basically the uterus is completely sterile. There's no bacteria, there's nothing in there. And puppies and kittens and human babies are basically developing without any contact with bacteria. But we know today that this is not true anymore. Well, we know better, I should say. We know that there are bacteria that are in contact with the placenta, and that completely changes what we thought about microbial colonization in puppies and kittens, in human babies, in all kind of newborns, actually. Because this colonization starts before those individuals are born. And when you think of it, it's actually mind-blowing, because we used to think that newborns inherit the genes from their parents, but they not only inherit the genes, but they also inherit the bacteria as well, because the bacteria from the mother are actually going to participate in the microbial development of those puppies and kittens. And basically, when they're born, their microbiome is the reflection of the microbiome of their mother, which tells you how important it is to have this connection. There is this field of research, which is called DOHAD. It stands for Developmental Origin of Health and Diseases in Humans. It used to be called a theory. In humans, they have this thing that is called the 1,000-day theory, which I always make fun of. I say it has nothing to do with the Big Bang theory. It just tells you that everything that happens to the human baby is actually influenced by the first 1,000 day of life, which starts from conception, actually. And today, it's really foundational science. We know that everything that impacts the mother or that impacts the development during gestation, lactation, after birth has an impact on the health of those individuals later in their life, which makes this critical. So bacteria are actually interacting with those newborns even before birth, starting from the moment almost of conception.
Fascinating. So when we think of natural birth versus C-section, then is there a difference with the mode of delivery? Does that alter microbial development?
Yes. And it's very important because, I mean, when I work in clinics at the vet school, we were doing a lot of C-sections because, you know, certain breeds are predisposed to have C-sections. And C-sections are great tools. I remember one paper we published many, many years ago on elective C-sections in dogs. And for me, the best finding was that we had a 0% neonatal mortality rate. When you think of it, that's awesome because that's what you want. You want to optimize the survival of those newborns. And sometimes, you know, when you're in clinic, you think, hey, there is this female coming for dystocia, whether a dog or a cat. Maybe I should just go straight to C-section. Actually, 80% of the dystocia cases we see in our clinics end up with a C-section. But in the end, we think, oh, we are optimizing neonatal survival. That's what we want. And that's true. But I keep telling my students these days that C-sections are tools, not shortcuts. And that's very important because it does have an impact on the microbiome development. When you look at, there have been several studies that have been done in recent years showing that actually when you have a puppy or a kitten that is born by C-section, its microbiome is less diverse than a puppy or a kitten born by natural whelping. And that makes sense because it hasn't been in contact with all the bacteria in the vagina of their mother. It hasn't been in contact with all the maternal fluids and everything. But when it gets even more interesting, remember I told you about this elective C-section that I loved practicing because it was so much more convenient because you have a team and everything. It was perfect. But they found that when you do an elective C-section, you actually, the microbiome is even less diverse than when you do an emergency C-section compared to a natural birth. So when you think of it, your tool that this tool, this elective C-section tool that we are using to optimize neonatal survival actually comes with less microbial diversity in those newborns. And we know that this is correlated with their long-time health because those bacteria in the gut, they participate in many, many, many different mechanisms. They participate in immune development. They participate in brain development. I have in one of my presentations, I have a little slide that shows how the gut microbiome is connected to all the different organs. And I think there's basically all of them. So, and by doing C-section, actually, we can interfere with this normal development. So don't get me wrong here. I don't want to demonize C-sections. Yeah. As I said, C-sections are tools, not shortcuts. But we need to keep that in mind because when we do C-sections, we optimize neonatal survival, but there are some consequences. The trick today and the goal today is to find how to overcome those consequences.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I didn't know that actually. Even there is a difference between emergency C-sections versus a planned or scheduled C-section. And so what evidence-based strategies exist to support or restore healthy microbiome development in those critical early days then?
That's $1 million question, right? When you and you see in today, let's be fair. There are no clear strategy yet. Many of our colleagues in clinics, they mimic what is done in human medicine. And in human medicine, in certain circumstances, when they do those C-sections, they will take a swab and they will swab typically the vagina of the mother or the maternal fluids, etc. And they will take this swab and basically put it in the mouth of the newborn, on the face of the newborn, in order to help for the transfer of those bacteria from the mother to the newborn. And that's something I have many colleagues who are doing that when they do a C-section in veterinary medicine today. We all say, oh, there's no evidence, it really works, but we are doing it because That's the best we have to date.
Yeah.
There was one study that was published last year by a team in Brazil that actually showed that when they were doing this technique that we call vaginal seeding, there was no consequence and no impact on the improvement of the microbiome of those newborns. So again, it's one study. I'm sure we can criticize the material and methods on and on, but it tells us that there might be something there, but we are not there yet so far. That
Yeah.
being said, we have other options. In one of the things that is very important is to make sure that those newborns receive the colostrum, the first milk of the mother. That's critical because this milk, this first milk, we always, see it as an immune booster. That's what I remember when I was in vet school. I was taught that, oh, the colostrum contains a lot of immunoglobulins, and this is how puppies and kittens acquire their immunity. But it's much more than that. And among many things those newborns receive from the colostrum, it's bacteria. The colostrum is a mega bacterial booster for those newborns. So you really want to make sure that those newborns receive the colostrum after birth, especially if they were born by C-section. You want to put that in contact with the mother because they're on the skin of the mother, obviously, we have bacteria. And those bacteria will participate in the colonization of the gut. So as soon as possible, you want to put them in contact with the mother. And there's one last thing that is key, in my opinion, which is super interesting because we talk a lot about theories, Big Bang theory, 1,000-day theory, and there's another one called hygiene theory, which makes my wife crazy, I must admit. Hear me on this one. We always think that when you have newborns, in their environment must be as clean as possible. You want to clean and disinfect and make sure there are no bacteria in there because it could potentially infect those newborns, lead to septicemia, and blah, blah, blah. But actually, those germs in the environment are going to be part of the colonization of the microbiome. So you want the space, the whelping area to be clean, but you don't want it to be sterile. And I'm a big proponent of a concept that we use a lot in shelter medicine, which is called spot cleaning, where basically you do not clean to kill the germs, because this is what we were taught in vet school. You want to remove all the risk of infectious diseases, just clean and disinfect with tough disinfectants, etc. We do spot cleaning in the whelping area as well, just to make sure that it is clean, but it is not so clean that there are no germs, because those germs actually play a role in the development of the microbiome. So those are the three things that today we can leverage to make sure that we are going to support the microbiome development in those newborns that are born from from C-section, basically.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, well let's talk a little bit more about mom and her nutritional needs too, because we gotta because take it I'm thinking of taking it one step further to figure out, okay, well maybe we can pass some of the good stuff over to mom. And so how does mom's nutrition and overall microbiome health during gestation and lactation shape the offspring's gut microbiome, and where can veterinarians such as ourselves have the greatest impact?
So clearly, based on what we said earlier, it's critical because the microbiome of those newborn puppies and kittens is really the reflection of the microbiome of their mother. So you want to optimize as much as possible the microbiome of those mothers before they give birth. And that should start, honestly, since the beginning of gestation, even before that. You can use typically, when it comes to microbiome optimization, there are two main tools that are recommended today, really, when you think of it. And there is a third one. We're going to talk about it later. But probiotics, this is a way to optimize the microbiome inside the digestive tract of a female, or prebiotics. So basically, fibers, anything that can feed the good bacteria, basically, to ensure that you maintain the population of healthy bacteria instead of the population of bad bacteria, to make it simple. And today, for me, one of the keys is clearly nutrition. The way you feed the mother, as you can see, has a huge impact on the bacteria in the gut, and basically then on the puppies and kittens. You want to make sure that the diet you pick is optimized for digestive safety. So typically, those diets are hyperdigestible. They contain those prebiotics we mentioned earlier. They contain antioxidants that are going to participate as well in microbiome health. So that's the key, making sure that the diet that is picked during this time is optimized for that. One thing for cats, for mothers especially, which is kind of interesting, in cats, there is a study that has showed that if you feed a dry diet, it activates a certain population of good bacteria. If you feed a wet diet, it activates a certain population of good bacteria, but it's a different one. So mixed feeding, which is something typically recommended in cats, it could actually be a way to have a holistic activation of the good bacteria in the gut, which is critical for the mothers before they give birth, obviously. And that's something I would definitely do in cats. In dogs, mixed feeding is interesting in small dogs when you want them to get more water, obviously. But in cats, we already have plenty of indications. And for me, one which is important would also be this holistic activation of the microbiome. And I mentioned probiotics. Probiotics are interesting because very often when we think, oh, we want to optimize the microbiome, we're going to give them probiotics. And recently, there was a probiotic that was presented at different repro conferences that, to my knowledge, is the first probiotic that actually is able to optimize reproductive performances. And by that, I mean that when you feed this probiotic to the mother during gestation, you can actually have an improvement in milk quality and colostrum quality. You will have an improvement in the protein content of the milk, which obviously is important for growth of those newborns, but you will also have a more homogeneous growth. So this is what they call nutritional priming. And it shows you that by playing with the microbiome, this is actually a way to optimize the microbiome of those newborns even before they are born. So the probiotic I'm mentioning is called Saccharomyces boulardii CM11079. The key here is the 1079 because it's a specific strain, and you really want to use this specific strain because it's the only one that has been proven, to my knowledge, to optimize those parameters when you feed them to the female dog during gestation. We don't have data in cats today, maybe in the future, but in dogs at least, this is definitely something I'd recommend today to
So is
use.
that genus and species, is that found in your typical probiotics then that a breeder or an owner can get, or is it, a specific type of one?
So this is a typical probiotic. It's not your typical probiotic in the sense that it is a yeast. It's not a bacteria. So which comes with some advantages, like it doesn't require to be refrigerated. It has a longer shelf life. When the animal receive antibiotics at the same time, it doesn't interfere. And this one today is available in the US in vet clinics, pet shops. So it's widely available. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And it's by itself then, I'm assuming then, or is it with like your
Yes.
typical?
Yes.
Okay.
It, no,
Got it.
it's by itself. It's by
Okay.
itself. You basically have a little sachet, as they call it, which
Okay.
contains the prebiotic powder.
Okay.
The
Got it.
probiotic powder, sorry, not prebiotic. Always
Okay.
mixed up those two.
Let's talk about the shift that happens from when they're going from milk to solid foods, because I'm sure there's gotta be microbiome shift that happens there. And so, what's the best way to manage weaning to support gut health? And what are some common mistakes that you see?
So I think you are touching on something very important because, like you said, this is when we see the biggest microbial shift. Because think of it, the bacteria in the gut of those puppies and kittens, they are used to grow and develop on milk. And suddenly you switch to something completely different. So obviously you have a dramatic population shift overnight. One very important clinical element for all of us veterinarians is that typically weaning diarrhea, which is very, very common, 25% of puppies will develop it. There was a study in shelters that showed that 65% of kittens that unfortunately died during the weaning period were suffering from diarrhea. So it shows you how important it is. But this typically happens 4 days after beginning of the weaning transition because of this huge microbiome shift. So critical and really something we need to properly approach. And I'm going to be very practical here because that's really for me where we can make a big difference. Weaning diarrhea, which, as I said, is a common issue in puppies and kittens, is really a syndrome. Think of it as a combination of nutritional factors, infectious disease factors, and environmental factors. So when we just look at the nutrition, the first thing that is very important is to target what we call biological readiness. You see, if you had asked me this question like 2 years ago, I would have told you, you know, Dr. Krusman, we start weaning at 4 weeks because I think we need a very clear protocol and that's better. But today, after talking with many colleagues and also looking at the recent literature, I wouldn't say we have this, we should focus on this date. Because really what we want is to make sure those newborn, those puppies and kittens, they are not newborns anymore, but we want to make sure they are ready to be weaned. So you're looking for instance, do they have teeth? Because if they have teeth, it tells you that, okay, they might be able to start chewing those this solid food that you're giving them. You want to make sure they are able to properly stand on their paws. Because if they are not, if they're still crawling a little bit, it means it's way too early because they won't be able to properly ingest the food. You want to make sure that their growth is not stagnating, because that tells you that this means the milk of the mother is not sufficient to support their growth. So, and all those things can be actually evaluated. So today I tell people, check this biological readiness, check the presence of teeth, check obviously their posture, and monitor their growth. We have these tools that are neonatal growth charts. You and I talked about that in a previous podcast. And for me, those are game changers, because at the time of weaning, those growth charts will show you that there is kind of a plateau. And when you visualize this plateau, this tells you, okay, they are not gaining enough from the milk. We must transition them to this solid food. This is the biological readiness. That's the key to determine when you will start weaning. And for instance, you see, I was telling you 4 weeks in the past, but if you look at small dogs, in small dogs, more and more, I will start the weaning process around 5, 6 weeks after birth. Large dogs, much earlier. So for instance, in your Dachshund, it would be a little bit later than on a Great Dane.
So yeah, on the Great Dane, what would it be? Would it be longer towards more of the 8 weeks?
No, it will be earlier. So in Great Danes, it will be more like around 3, 4 weeks of age. We'll start earlier.
Okay, gotcha. Yes.
Earlier. That's what I've been, earlier, typically. And so that would be when you do the weaning. Then the key is really to make it smooth and progressive. One of the biggest mistakes I see people doing is that they will directly give solid food. No transition. You want this to be as smooth as possible. You want to start this as, it should be like a gruel, you know, something very, with a almost a liquid, liquid consistency, so that they can basically lick it. And progressively, when they get the ability to chew, they move to something solid. But that should be done over 4 weeks, not in 1 week. Sometimes people want to do the weaning very fast. Weaning, again, should be smooth and progressive. 4 weeks minimum. So when we start depends, 4 weeks minimum. And 4 is the magic number, actually, because you want also to do 4 meals per day. And when you think of it, that makes complete sense, because the more smaller meals you give, the less digestive workload. So basically, it increases the digestibility of the diet. And we have studies showing that it leads to an improvement in stool quality, actually. And we have the study in puppies. I do the same in kittens with great results. We often say that, you know, kittens should not be meal fed, but at the time of weaning, I believe we should meal feed them. And in kittens, always the same, you know, we always want to do this mixed feeding thing I mentioned earlier because of the benefits of the microbiome. But when it comes to weaning, 4 is the magic number, except for when to start the weaning. That has changed.
Got it. So when a puppy or kitten starts to present to me and I'm trying to evaluate if their microbiome is developing appropriately, what are some things that we should be looking at as practitioners? And are there any red flags that we should be like, oh, something's off?
Mm-hmm. Two main things, in my opinion. The first, the stool consistency. So, you know, we have those fecal charts that I remember when I was in clinic, I had no idea how to use those. I'm like,
I know,
come
me
on.
Too. I was like,
it's like, oh, they have diarrhea. Okay. But when you look at it, there are many nuances of diarrhea, I should say. And
Yes.
I think those charts are great because you can show them to the customer and tell them, okay, what does the stool look like? If the stool is what you expect, and the number might vary depending on the score chart you're using, but if it's what is considered normal, it's a good reflection of the health of the microbiome. If it's too soft or too hard, it tells you that something is off there and that you might need a microbiome intervention. So that's really the first tool. I use it a lot when we deal with diarrhea in puppies and kittens, for instance, because it helps you identify the different tier of gravity of the case and decide basically on your microbiome medicine intervention that you're going to decide on. That's the first thing, the score chart. The second one is the weight. A healthy puppy slash kitten gains weight on a daily basis. If they're gaining weight, it means they're healthy, and it's a good reflection of the health of the microbiome. So those are really the two things you want to consider. And in my opinion, those are the best markers we can leverage qualitatively, honestly, and quantitatively when you think of it, because it's a score, to assess microbiome quality. In the future, in a very near future, in our vet clinics, I think we will start using other tools. There is one called fecal calprotectin. You might have heard about it. It's a test that identifies inflammation of the gut. And this is something they use a lot in cases of chronic diarrhea in cats and dogs. But in puppies and kittens, it can be very interesting to help differentiate the type of microbiome issue we are dealing with. So those tests are rapid tests that we can use in clinics. I know they are sold in Europe. It says that on their website that they're selling them in US and Canada, but I'm not sure how easy it is at the moment. But those would be the tools we will be able to use in our diagnostic approach. And the other one, which I wouldn't use it as a first line, in my first line of diagnostics, but that I would potentially use it as a follow-up tool, are those dysbiosis index. That are now available for all veterinary practitioners. So this is mainly to monitor the recovery of the microbiome, but that could be worth using in the future in certain cases where, for instance, you have a chronic diarrhea in a puppy or a kitten and you suspect that the microbiome has been severely impacted and you want to ensure that it is recovering. So those will be great tools to use for this kind of monitoring. And now they are mainstream, everybody can use them. But I really insist, this is not something I would do on a puppy or a kitten showing up at the clinic for acute diarrhea, but I would consider it for monitoring a chronic diarrhea case in those individuals.
That's interesting. There's a lot more, in my experience in practicing now, there's a lot more pet parents that are actually purchasing the kits themselves and doing a microbiome analysis to see what type of dysbiosis there is. And then they match that with what kind of probiotic or nutrition is best for their puppy or kitten, which I think is fascinating. It's like next level conversation that we're having in the exam room and trying to figure out what works better. Because I just will add this final thing, because I'm sure many of the listeners are saying this, well, we want to rule out parasites. That's the number one thing. If we see a puppy or kitten that's not thriving, we automatically want to just maybe, give the dewormer, because sometimes we're sending the stool sample out, it might take a day or two to get the results. But this is next level conversation, because what if the stool is actually normal, like no parasites are detected and they still look like they're not thriving? This is where, yeah, I think having that conversation of like dysbiosis or microbiome shift, right?
And I think we can go even deeper on that one. Think of the parasites. Anytime you have a Giardia, Coccidia, or a Trichomonas in cats, in kittens, you should not just see them as parasites. They are also microbiome disruptors because they are also associated with the dysbiosis. And actually, sometimes I see that a lot with Trichomonas, for instance. We have the Trichomonas, we treat it, it disappears, but there's still diarrhea. And that might be the consequence, actually, of the inflammation and the dysbiosis induced by the Trichomonas. And then it feels like a vicious circle. You treat, it goes away, and then you stop treating, and it comes back just because of this persistent effect. And I think this is why anytime we treat a parasite, we should always have in mind as well, okay, what should we do to optimize the microbiome of this puppy and kitten? at the same time. And that will impact the drugs we're using, that will impact the nutrition we are using, the biotic support we are using, all of those, which completely changes the conversation. And I wanted to add something because you talked about this dysbiosis index that people are using. We need to be careful in puppies and kittens, because when you use it in puppies and kittens, their microbiome is maturing. So basically, when you read the number, you might find that they're dysbiotic. This might actually be normal because their microbiome is maturing. It doesn't reach the normal level yet. And that's why it's a great tool for monitoring. But for just a snapshot in a growing puppy or kitten, it might not give you the perfect picture that you're looking for here.
Yeah. You're literally speaking of a case I'm dealing with right now. Shannon, if you're listening, this one's for you because she's a really good friend of mine. And she has a Shih Tzu that is chronic Giardia. And the issue is once we put her on her dog on the medication, there's complete dysbiosis that happens with it too. And this is one where she actually did do a GI panel study and looked for microbiomes and so forth. So doing probiotics, everything. But I agree with you. And I was telling her, I think the Giardia is killing the bacteria, the good bacteria in the gut. And it's creating this cycle that we're dealing with, trying to, get rid of the cysts. So she's doing fine now, but like it was interesting because there was a flare-up that happened again where, she had it. And but once we treated and then we went long term, no antibiotics or actually just deworming medication for this one. We didn't do Flagyl for this one, but we got it. And but just long term probiotics, this dog's been phenomenal on it. So.
And I'm with you on that one. It's interesting you mentioned Flagyl because, as we know, metronidazole, which was the go-to tool for many of us when we were dealing with diarrhea, severely disrupt the microbiome. In a recent
Yes.
presentation I gave on this topic, I call it the microbiome grenade, literally, because when you look, it like fucks up
Yes.
everything. And then it takes time to recover. Microbiome recovery takes at least 4 weeks. So sometimes we want instant improvement, while actually we need to wait. And this is where the tool is good because it shows you progressive improvement. This is where the fecal score is good because a fecal score, an isolated fecal score, doesn't give you the full picture, but several records, it shows you a progression. If you have a positive progression, it means you are on the right track. So fascinating. It really changed how we approach the
Yes.
veterinary medicine, I think.
Which I love. I mean, this is what the advancement of science is, I mean, back in the day, we would have just talked about using Flagyl and maybe changing the diet over, and it's much more next level, very individualized care that we're providing, which I love, and all the science that you and our colleagues are doing is fantastic. This is I could talk to you forever about this. I'm just so fascinated by this. So thank you so much for all your expertise. I know you're on LinkedIn. We can find you on LinkedIn, of course, if anybody's interested in learning more about you. And I know you do a lot of speaking events and papers. Anything else that I'm missing? Because I know you do so many things.
No, I think that's all. It's mainly speaking engagements today, these days,
Yes,
talking
absolutely.
about
Well,
puppy and kitten health.
yeah. Well, it doesn't get any better than that. It's my soft spot. I love it. Dr. Emmanuel
Yes.
Fontaine, thank you so much for being on the show and all the great work that you're doing, my friend. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me and thanks for everything. That was awesome.
Absolutely. And thank you for tuning in. And don't forget to rate this wonderful podcast. This is fantastic. As always, we'd love to bring you different topics as we continue to grow and develop. And I think, I'm not sure, we might be at the 500th podcast. I'm not sure if you're the one, Dr. Fontaine, but we're right up there.
Whoa.
Yeah. Five. Yeah.
Where's the birthday cake or the anniversary cake?
Where are the metronidazole bomb grenades? Well, thank you so much again, and we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast Podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast Podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.